Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
Today, we are diving into what we're calling the federal news update for Friday, November 14th, 2025.
And we are looking at the 48 hours right after the end of the longest government shutdown in U.S. history.
A full 43 days. It finally concluded with the signing of H.R. 5371. And our mission today is to give you, the listener, a comprehensive, truly exhaustive, and granular report on basically every major action the federal government took since the moment the clock ticked over to November 13th, 2025.
You know, this was less of a governmental restart and more of an institutional explosion. It really was.
An explosion.
Yeah. All that political and regulatory energy that was pent up for 6 weeks, it didn't just, you know, resume. It detonated.
Yeah.
Across every single department.
So the story of these 2 days, November 13th and 14th, is really one of aggressive score settling.
Score settling, a frantic attempt to pivot the entire national narrative and the immediate creation of new high-stakes crises. We saw institutional warfare just resume at full throttle.
That framing is so important. So we're not looking at stability returning here. We're looking at a government that instantly accelerated right back into conflict.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start with the legislative and executive action that officially ended the shutdown, the signing of H.R. 5371.
A bill the White House immediately branded as the end of the Democrat shutdown.
Of course.
President Trump signed the bill very late Wednesday night, November 12th, so it became effective early Thursday morning, November 13th.
And the White House PR machine was ready.
Oh, it was already spinning. They were publicizing the exact duration, 42 days, 22 hours, and 25 minutes, to just maximize the political optics of, you know, forcing the opposition to concede.
Let's walk through the political mechanics of that, because the way this bill passed is really the core of the compromise, or maybe the lack of one.
Right. The House passed it 222-209. Very tight.
But the Senate vote, that was the real nail biter, 60 to 40.
The absolute bare minimum needed to break a filibuster.
So what does that 60-40 split really tell us? I mean, what does it mean for any future negotiation?
It tells us that the Republican leadership achieved its objective by capitalizing on this deep internal fracture inside the opposition party.
Because that 60-40 margin meant senators had to cross the aisle.
Eight of them. Eight Democratic caucusing senators had to break ranks to get that bill over the line.
And who were they?
It was Catherine Cortez, Masto of Nevada, Dick Durbin of Illinois, John Fetterman from Pennsylvania, Tim Kaine of Virginia.
Also, Jackie Rosen of Nevada, Jean Shaheen and Maggie Hassan from New Hampshire, and the independent Angus King of Maine.
Right. Eight senators who decided to buck their own leadership.
And here's the critical question. What did they actually secure in exchange for giving the president and the Republican leadership this victory?
This is where it becomes a political tragedy, really, especially for millions of ordinary Americans.
But they got what?
They secured a massive political loss. I mean, to put it bluntly, the non-negotiable demand of the Democratic leadership.
The extension of the Enhanced Affordable Care Act tax credits, the ACA subsidies.
Yes, that was completely 100% not included in the final bill.
So these credits, which are keeping premiums marriageable for millions of people,
they're still set to expire at the end of December, in just a few weeks.
So what did those eight defecting senators get? What was the trade?
They received only a non-binding promise.
A non-binding promise.
From the Republican leadership, specifically Majority Leader John Thune. A promise for a standalone vote on those tax credits sometime in mid-December.
So they traded their immediate leverage, the shutdown itself, for a vote that could very well be doomed in a few weeks.
Exactly. And the consequence of that failure is massive, and it is immediate.
And we can measure it, right?
You can absolutely measure it. Huh. The Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, had already modeled the impact of letting these credits lapse.
And their projections.
Without this extension, the CBO says premiums will, and this is their language, more than double for millions of Americans who rely on these subsidies.
More than double.
And beyond just the cost increase, over 2 million people could lose their health insurance coverage entirely next year.
We have a quote here from Senate Leader Chuck Schumer. He said, "Never have American families faced a situation where their health care costs are set to double in the blink of an eye."
So those eight defectors, they ended the shutdown, sure, but they effectively conceded the entire core policy battle. They just kicked the health care crisis down the road to a date where all the political leverage will be gone.
And beyond the ACA, the bill itself, HR 5371, was this complicated hybrid. It felt like a legislative Frankenstein's monster.
That's the perfect description, because it was designed to stabilize certain political constituencies while immediately manufacturing new high-stakes deadlines.
It was part full funding and part short-term funding.
Exactly. It achieved full stabilization, so funding all the way through fiscal year 2026 for a few key areas.
Which were?
The Departments of Agriculture, which is critical because it includes SNAP, the Food Assistance Program, also Veterans Affairs, military construction, and very critically, the legislative branch itself.
So Congress made sure to fund itself through 2026.
Of course. This was a clear political calculation. Protect veterans, protect the food supply, and make sure Congress gets paid while leaving the rest of the government on a very short leash.
And that short leash is the continuing resolution, the CR.
Right. Which means most other agencies, and we're talking about highly visible ones like the Department of Justice, Treasury, Homeland Security, they are only funded until January 30th, 2026.
So this legislative structure deliberately creates two new fiscal cliffs for you, the public, to worry about.
Two new high-stakes cliffs. First, the likely failure of that promised ACA vote in mid-December. And second, a full government shutdown threat right back on the table just 10 weeks from now at the end of January.
So instead of resolving the crisis, they just postponed it and accelerated another one.
And the fact that the legislative branch fully funded itself while leaving the bulk of the executive branch unstable, well, that just encapsulates the dysfunction perfectly.
Okay, before we move on from the bill itself, we have to talk about this hidden political maneuver, the one that averted what could have been an absolute financial collapse.
The unpublicized Medicare lifeline.
Yes, hidden deep inside this funding bill.
This is a detail that was, I think, deliberately obscured by all the high-stakes political messaging, but it's arguably the most consequential fiscal action in the entire bill.
And that was the waiver for statutory pay-as-you-go.
Pay-go, yeah. The legislation included a critical waiver of PGO requirements.
Okay, for listeners who might not be familiar, can you break down what PGO is and why it was threatening $500 billion in cuts?
Sure. PBGO is basically a budget enforcement rule that's been around for decades. In essence, if Congress passes laws that increase the deficit over a certain period, say, through massive tax cuts or new spending, a statutory clock starts ticking.
And when that clock runs out?
Once it runs out, PBGO triggers automatic across-the-board spending cuts to what are called non-exempt programs to offset that deficit increase.
And the long-term impact of previous laws, like the big tax cuts, had set this mechanism in motion.
Precisely. The trigger point was fast approaching. On the very day the government reopened, the long-term fiscal scorekeeping would have triggered an automatic, catastrophic $530 billion cut to Medicare spending.
A $500 billion cut to Medicare.
And that's not a political talking point. It's a statutory mechanism. A cut of that magnitude would have just decimated the healthcare system overnight. It would have impacted payments to doctors, hospitals, beneficiaries, everything.
So the PAGO waiver was inserted to stop that bomb from detonating.
Exactly. It was necessary, but it just highlights how deeply unstable our fiscal rules are, that a shutdown resolution had to simultaneously prevent a healthcare catastrophe of that scale.
So the stability of our entire healthcare system post-shutdown now hinges on two things: a non-binding promise for a vote in December, and an obscure waiver that stopped Medicare from being cut by $500 billion.
That's the state of play.
That summary really sets the stage for the chaotic human experience of this restart. Beyond the high-stakes politics, the immediate focus shifted to the federal workforce and just getting money flowing again.
And the immediate human cost was enormous. I mean, both financially and emotionally. Some analysts estimate the long-term economic damage from the 43 days could be anywhere from $7 to $14 billion.
But for the 1.4 million affected federal employees, the stress was personal and it was immediate.
Thankfully, the legislation did guarantee back pay for all of them. The furloughed workers, at least 670,000 of them, and those who had to work without pay, which was about 730,000.
And it also reversed a critical step toward mass layoffs, right?
Yes, the deal reserved layoffs for roughly 4,000 federal employees who had already received their RAF notices. That's reduction in force back in October.
Yeah.
But it prohibited any further RAFs until that new January 30th deadline.
And that was especially crucial for the Internal Revenue Service.
The IRS in particular, yeah. They had already lost about 25% of their workforce this year through just voluntary attrition programs.
And why is that RAF reversal at the IRS so important right now?
Well, the IRS is just scrambling. They're trying to hire and train staff ahead of the upcoming tax filing season. The agency was forced to rescind layoff notices that were sent primarily to HR and IT employees.
The very people they need to function.
The exact staff they need to modernize and just keep the lights on. Losing them now would have absolutely guaranteed a chaotic and damaging tax season for 2026.
But, you know, guaranteed back pay doesn't mean you get cash in your hand immediately. The information we're seeing shows this profoundly staggered schedule.
Which meant continued financial anxiety for days after the government officially reopened.
This granularity is so important because it really illustrates the unevenness of the federal bureaucracy.
It does. The OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, it urged agencies to pay expeditiously. But the timing varies widely. It all depends on which payroll provider or shared service center an agency uses.
Which is why the deposits didn't all just happen on Friday. So let's walk through that specific schedule, because for many of our listeners who are federal employees, these dates determine whether they could, you know, pay rent or buy groceries.
Okay, so the first wave was expected for Saturday deposits. This included employees from smaller administrative bodies, like the General Services Administration, GSA, and OPM itself. They tend to use their own dedicated systems.
Then, moving into Sunday, deposits were expected for the Department of Veterans Affairs, the Department of Energy, Health and Human Services, and, critically, Defense Department civilians.
And it's important to remember, active duty military pay stayed on schedule through the whole shutdown, but the hundreds of thousands of DOD civilian employees were definitely impacted.
Right. Then on Monday, we had the Departments of Education, State, Interior, and Transportation.
Along with key independent agencies like the EPA, the National Science Foundation, Social Security Administration, and NASA, these agencies often rely on a different set of payroll processors.
And finally, the long wait until the middle of the week.
Wednesday deposits were projected for the agencies using the National Finance Center, or NFC, payroll provider. And this includes the huge cabinet agencies.
Right.
Agriculture, Commerce, Treasury, Labor, Justice, Homeland Security, HUD, and the SBA.
Just imagine that. You're an employee of the Department of Justice. You're told the government is open on Thursday, but you won't actually see your paycheck until the following Wednesday.
The delay just fueled this immense frustration. We have reports of deep financial stress. Elizabeth McPeak, an IRS employee, shared stories of her colleagues being forced to beg landlords to defer rent, relying on food banks just to survive that six-week gap.
And the emotional toll. We saw a report from Jessica Sweet, a Social Security claims specialist, who described cutting back drastically, skipping meals, maxing out her credit cards for just basic necessities like gas.
The feeling among so many federal workers, according to our sources, was that they were just treated like political pawns.
And that the final deal, which sacrificed the ACA extension, was a total betrayal.
Absolutely. Adam Pelletier, an NLRB field examiner, he captured that sentiment perfectly. He said the resolution felt like the Charlie Brown cartoon, where Lucy holds the football and pulls it out.
So the return to work was just colored by this deep resentment.
Toward both parties, for using them as leverage.
And this financial chaos wasn't limited to the federal workforce. One of the most severe crises was the disruption of SNAP food assistance.
For 42 million Americans. And this led to a really dramatic constitutional clash.
So the shutdown had disrupted the scheduled payments for SNAP benefits.
Right. And this prompted a lawsuit in Rhode Island. A district judge, John J. McConnell Jr., ordered the administration to immediately issue the full November SNAP benefits.
Citing what?
He cited the clear and present danger of irreparable harm to millions of vulnerable people. But the administration immediately appealed.
On what grounds?
They claimed the judiciary couldn't force the executive branch to spend money that Congress hadn't actually appropriated yet.
And that appeal went straight to the Supreme Court late on Friday afternoon. What happened there?
Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson issued an administrative stay. She temporarily blocked Judge McConnell's lower court order.
And that was a massive decision.
Huge. It essentially reinforced the executive branch's control over the Treasury and limited the judiciary's ability to intervene in these spending disputes, even when there's a catastrophic human impact.
But the stay created instant chaos because some states had already started to comply with the district court's order.
Precisely. This highlights the dangers of, you know, judicial whiplash in a crisis. States like Wisconsin had already disbursed over $104 million in benefits to comply with Judge McConnell's ruling.
So what happened when Justice Jackson issued the stay?
Those state officials were reportedly threatened with penalties by the federal government if they didn't somehow undo the payments.
Undo them? How is that even possible?
It's not. State officials called it a catastrophic operational disruption. Clawing back food assistance that's already been distributed is logistically and, frankly, ethically impossible.
So 42 million vulnerable Americans were caught first in a political shutdown and then in the middle of a constitutional fight between the judicial and executive branches over who controls the purse strings.
It's a truly profound consequence of this kind of gridlock. It just reveals the limits of judicial compassion when it's balanced against constitutional authority over appropriations. The courts might see the humanitarian crisis, but they generally can't force the executive to spend money that isn't there.
Okay, let's shift back to immediate operations. Air travel stability was a huge concern. What did the Transportation Department do?
The Transportation Department immediately froze its flight reduction plan at 6%.
They'd been preparing to increase that, right?
To 10%, yeah. Air traffic controllers were working without pay, and that was leading to massive delays and cancellations. So by freezing the reduction, they stabilized the national airspace system.
But it wasn't an instant fix.
No. The Transportation Secretary warned it would still take up to a week for air travel to fully normalize, which is especially concerning with the Thanksgiving travel rush just around the corner.
And here we find the first really overt high-level political statement that was tied directly to the operational restart.
The DHS Secretary's TSA bonus announcement.
Right. The Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, she announced a pretty significant bonus.
A $10,000 bonus for TSA officers who demonstrated exemplary service during the shutdown, so taking extra shifts, maintaining security standards, things like that.
But the announcement was pure political messaging.
100%. The official press release explicitly framed the bonus as a reward for employees who served admirably despite the Democrats' shutdown. They were using taxpayer funds as a mechanism for political narrative control.
But DHS's immediate restart also brought immediate legal challenges about its own internal policies.
Yes, right on the heels of the shutdown ending, a transgender TSA officer named Danielle Mitterer filed a federal lawsuit against DHS alleging sex discrimination.
And this lawsuit challenges a policy that was put in place back in February.
Right. To comply with a Trump administration executive order that defined two unchangeable sexes for federal employment purposes.
So what are the specific implications of this policy for TSA officers like her?
Well, the policy bars transgender officers from conducting security screening pat-downs or even from serving as witnesses in private screening areas.
And Mitterer's lawsuit argues what?
That these restrictions impede her career advancement, they prevent her from fulfilling duties that were previously assigned to her, and they also bar her from using TSA facility restrooms that align with her gender identity.
And the DHS response.
A spokesperson justified the policy, questioning whether critics wanted female travelers to be subjected to pat-downs by male TSA officers, arguing the policy prioritizes security and public comfort. It's setting the stage for a major legal battle over identity and federal employment law.
So on the operational side, we see a department that's simultaneously rewarding staff with political bonuses and defending a highly contested social policy in federal court.
Which transitions us perfectly into the aggressive policy blitz that the executive branch launched to pivot the national narrative away from all this gridlock.
Exactly. While the workforce was dealing with the chaos of pay schedules and the courts were ruling on food stamps, the executive branch wasn't waiting for things to stabilize.
No, they were executing a massive, coordinated pivot strategy. And we could start with the first part of that pivot. The Fostering the Future executive order signed on November 13th.
On its surface, this sounds like a pretty non-controversial modernization effort, especially being led by First Lady Melania Trump.
The initial directives certainly sound that way. The stated goals are improving data collection across the foster system, promoting the use of predictive analytics and tools powered by artificial intelligence for recruitment.
And creating a state-level performance scorecard within 180 days. All very forward-looking, high-tech reform.
But the politics, as they always are buried in the specific language. Specifically, Section 4.
Maximizing partnerships with Americans of faith.
This is the crux of the order. Section 4 explicitly commands the Secretary of Health and Human Services to take appropriate action to address state and local policies and practices that inappropriately prohibit participation by qualified organizations based on their sincerely held religious beliefs or moral convictions.
Okay, let's break down the practical effect of this for the listener. What kind of state policies is the administration actually trying to override here?
This is a direct shot at state and local non-discrimination laws. Many states and local jurisdictions, they prohibit faith-based adoption and foster care agencies from receiving public federal funds if those agencies discriminate against prospective parents.
Most commonly, LGBTQ plus individuals.
Exactly. So this EO uses the vehicle of foster care modernization to enforce a highly partisan objective, ensuring that federal funding flows unconditionally to faith-based agencies, overriding local civil rights protections if they conflict with religious conviction.
It's an ideological victory wrapped in a compassionate social policy package.
Precisely. And on the same day, the administration unleashed this powerful, coordinated blitz of international trade and economic diplomacy.
Clearly targeted at key political constituencies, farmers, manufacturers, the industrial base.
This was a masterclass in shifting the focus from D.C., infighting, to presidential deal-making on the world stage.
They started with these new framework agreements for the Western Hemisphere.
With Argentina, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Ecuador. And the explicit goal here is boosting U.S. exports by removing non-tariff barriers, which directly benefits the U.S. agricultural and industrial sector's key constituencies for the administration.
What are some concrete examples of those barriers being removed?
These are highly specific wins for American producers. Argentina, for instance, committed to simplifying product registration for U.S. beef and pork, and they also granted full market access for U.S. poultry.
And Ecuador.
Ecuador agreed to fully eliminate a variable tariff on specific agricultural products like U.S. wheat and fresh fruit.
And for manufacturers.
El Salvador and Guatemala agreed to recognize U.S. vehicle safety standards and accept FDA-certified medical devices without requiring redundant local certifications. That creates instant market access for U.S. manufacturers.
And immediately after this trade announcement, they publicized a massive Asia policy deal.
A deal signaling deep industrial alignment with the Republic of Korea.
The White House released a joint fact sheet detailing this colossal commitment from Korean Air.
Or KL, yeah. The airline committed to purchasing a huge mixed fleet of Boeing aircraft. The 737MX, 787 Dreamliners, and the 777X.
And the value of this order is just stunning.
$36 billion.
$36 billion. That's a massive commitment that goes way beyond a standard commercial aviation deal.
Oh, this is pure industrial diplomacy. First, it instantly injects cash and stability into Boeing, which is a cornerstone of the U.S. industrial base. That benefits American manufacturing workers in key states.
And geopolitically.
It deepens the alignment with the Republic of Korea. It locks them into the U.S. economic and defense ecosystem for decades, strengthening the alliance against regional rivals like China. It's a calculated, high-impact move designed to project economic strength and pivot the domestic narrative from gridlock to global wins.
And speaking of the White House, while this policy blitz was happening, there was a physical action on the premises itself that, well, it demonstrates a willingness to permanently alter historic federal property.
Indeed. During that executive order signing event, President Trump confirmed that the historic White House East Wing has been demolished to make way for a new, larger presidential ballroom. He commented that the site looks pretty nice right now, but that it would look a lot better in a little while, suggesting the project might be ongoing or even expanding.
That's a highly symbolic, permanent alteration of a national landmark.
It demonstrates a disregard for architectural preservation in favor of functional expansion.
So the White House pivoted aggressively across social policy, global trade, and even the physical structure of the executive mansion. Now let's move to the departmental actions and the unfrozen deregulatory agenda.
Right. These are the aggressive legal, financial, and regulatory moves taken by agencies as soon as their funding was back online.
And the Department of Justice, the DOJ, wasted absolutely zero time engaging in highly politicized legal action.
Immediately aiming at electoral politics in California.
Tell us about the lawsuit filed against California Governor Gavin Newsom and Secretary of State Shirley Weber on November 13th.
The DOJ filed a major lawsuit challenging California's newly enacted congressional redistricting plan, which was Proposition 50.
A plan that analysts projected could give Democrats up to 5 additional House seats in the 2026 midterms.
Exactly. And the DOJ's allegation is specific: unconstitutional racial gerrymandering. They claim the state improperly used Latino demographics and racial considerations to achieve its political ends.
But that lawsuit immediately drew intense scrutiny.
For its selective enforcement, yeah. The official allegation, framed by Attorney General Pamela Bondi, was that this was a necessary action to protect the 14th Amendment.
But they only sued California.
The DOJ filed suit only against the Democratic map in California, while declining to challenge Republican-drawn maps in other states that had been criticized by civil rights groups for similar, or even worse, partisan and racial manipulation.
So what does that selective enforcement imply for you, the listener, about the role of the DOJ in this environment?
It implies a clear partisan weaponization of the Civil Rights Division. The administration is using the department's legal power selectively to challenge a map that benefits Democrats, providing cover for its Republican allies who are fighting to retain a narrow House majority.
It transforms the department into an active participant in the redistricting battle.
Ahead of the 2026 midterms, yeah. It sets a worrying precedent for the impartial application of civil rights law.
Moving to the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, they also quickly resumed aggressive enforcement actions.
And coupled them with that clear political messaging we saw earlier with the TSA bonuses.
So on November 14th, it was confirmed that U.S. Border Patrol agents are scheduled to deploy to Charlotte, North Carolina.
As early as November 15th for an immigration crackdown.
But the official rationale for this was immediately undercut.
It was. The justification was linked to a recent high-profile fatal stabbing, but the suspect in that crime was not an immigrant.
So the enforcement action is completely detached from the official justification. What was the local impact?
Local leaders in Charlotte expressed immediate fear and confusion. The Mecklenburg County Sheriff confirmed his deputies would not participate in the federal operation, citing trust issues with the community.
And the community itself.
Advocates reported widespread panic. Parents of U.S. citizen children afraid to send them to school, fearing sweeps. This just mirrors Secretary Noem's overall strategy, using enforcement actions, even those based on questionable premises, to generate headlines and reinforce a hardline political narrative.
The Department of the Treasury, meanwhile, used the restart to engage in some very sophisticated financial warfare.
Against transnational criminal organizations, yeah. On November 13th, Treasury announced a major coordinated financial attack.
Starting with FinCEN.
FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, proposed rules to identify 10 specific Mexico-based gambling establishments as primary money laundering concerns.
And what's the practical power of that designation?
If it's finalized, that designation would be devastating to those businesses. It would effectively sever them from the U.S. financial system.
Meaning no U.S. banks can do business with them.
No banks, no brokers, no currency exchangers can process any transactions for them. It's a financial chokehold designed to cut off their access to all international commerce.
And at the same time, Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, was targeting human smuggling.
OFAC sanctioned the Pardwaj Human Smuggling Organization, its leader, and 16 associated companies.
So that freezes all their U.S.-based assets?
And prohibits any U.S. persons or companies from transacting with them. It shows a sophisticated, multi-pronged financial attack strategy using all of its financial tools against cartels and smugglers.
Okay, now let's turn to the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. The reopening of the Federal Register on November 14th signaled the immediate unfreezing of the administration's sweeping deregulatory agenda.
Two complex final rules were published right away,
which indicates they were ready to go, just sitting on ice during the shutdown.
Absolutely. The first one grants Texas primacy over Class 6 underground injection control, or UIC, wells.
This sounds highly technical, but the implications here are enormous for the energy transition. So explain what Class 6 UIC wells are and why granting Texas primacy matters so much.
Okay, so Class 6 wells are essential infrastructure for geologic carbon sequestration. That's the process of injecting carbon dioxide deep underground for permanent storage.
A technology critical for heavy industries trying to decarbonize.
Right. The problem has been that the federal EPA, which previously had sole permitting authority, had this massive backlog of hundreds of pending applications.
And that backlog effectively stalled billions of dollars in carbon capture projects.
Exactly. So by transferring this authority to the Texas Railroad Commission,
they are drastically accelerating the process.
The Texas Railroad Commission is famously industry friendly and has promised much faster permitting times. We're talking potentially months instead of years.
This is a huge victory for the energy dominance agenda.
It prioritizes economic speed and industry development over the more stringent and much slower federal environmental scrutiny. It's a key philosophical shift.
And the second rule concerned the industrial solvent trichloroethylene, or TC.
The EPA published a final rule that extends the postponement of a full ban on TCE under the Toxic Substances Control Act.
The original science supported a rapid ban, right, due to public health concerns.
It did. But this new rule pushes back compliance deadlines for specific industrial uses, notably in nuclear fuel manufacturing, until 2028, and for wastewater disposal until 2026.
And the rationale?
The EPA cited the prioritization of national security and critical infrastructure needs, arguing that a sudden ban would disrupt vital defense and energy sectors.
So, in effect, the first two major EPA actions upon reopening are rapidly accelerating carbon capture through deregulation and postponing a public health ban in favor of industrial continuity.
It's an aggressive and immediate resumption of the philosophy that governance should prioritize economic activity and national security over centralized environmental oversight.
Finally, let's look at the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. Its actions were a chaotic mix of emergency cleanup and a radical strategic pivot.
A pivot concerning the future of cryptocurrency regulation, yeah.
So the immediate cleanup was necessary because the shutdown left hundreds of companies in legal limbo.
Right. The SEC issued guidance after government shutdown on November 13th to provide legal clarity for the more than 900 issuers who had filed registration statements during the funding lapse,
which was critical to prevent market chaos.
It confirmed those statements would become effective automatically once the systems were back online. A huge relief for companies waiting to access capital markets.
But the truly seismic shift was the unveiling of Project Crypto.
This is a radical, almost immediate reversal of years of policy. Agency officials unveiled a new policy initiative aimed at making America the crypto capital of the world.
And the key headline-grabbing statement was their declaration that most crypto assets are not securities.
That reverses the entire previous approach, which critics had called regulation by enforcement.
Right. The old SEC assumed almost all digital assets were securities and used lawsuits to define the rules.
Precisely. This new Project Crypto policy aims to draw clear lines and proactively create safe harbors for innovation. It's shifting the dynamic from policing to promoting the crypto industry.
Trying to draw capital and talent that fled offshore back to the U.S.
Explicitly, yes. And this strategic pivot was immediately accompanied by a major personnel change.
The departure of Antonia M. Apps,
the deputy director of the Division of Enforcement. Given the radical shift away from enforcement-led regulation, the timing strongly suggests a strategic cleaning of house.
They're clearing the path of internal friction to rapidly implement this new deregulatory crypto-friendly policy.
That's how it appears. And while these high-profile agencies were firing on all cylinders, there were signs of lingering damage at other places, like the Federal Trade Commission.
Right. The FTC furloughed a large percentage of its staff because its functions were deemed non-essential.
And as a result, they were forced to postpone their 18th annual microeconomics conference. They explicitly cited the shutdown as the reason.
So that just highlights that while the White House and high-priority agencies can resume their political agendas immediately,
the non-essential long-term functions of government, the agencies that suffered massive staffing cuts, they can't just flip a switch back to normal operations.
We've covered the compromise, the workforce chaos, and the full-throttle executive pivot. Now we have to turn to the deepest layer of dysfunction. The institutional warfare that was happening right beneath the surface.
Where the branches of government were actively undermining each other.
And this is perhaps the most shocking part of these 48 hours. Let's start with a maneuver that shows Congress using the crisis to protect itself from investigation.
The Arctic Frost provision.
This was a sleeper provision reportedly slipped into H.R. 5371, the very bill that ended the shutdown. What did it do?
It was a purely self-serving legislative maneuver. It was designed to inoculate sitting senators against the executive branch. The provision allows any sitting senator to sue the federal government, specifically targeting the DOJ for accessing their data without their knowledge.
And the damages.
Statutory damages set at a minimum of $500,000 per violation.
And this was a direct response to a specific investigation.
It was. This provision was inserted in response to a special counsel investigation codenamed Arctic Frost.
What was that about?
Sources indicate this investigation had reportedly obtained, or tried to obtain, private communications and possibly financial data related to 8 Republican senators.
So they essentially used the must-pass funding bill to write themselves a massive legal protection policy.
Backed by $500,000 in taxpayer-funded damages if the DOJ crosses them. It's a stunning display of self-preservation.
And how did House leadership react to this Senate maneuver?
They were reportedly furious. House Speaker Johnson and other leaders were rattled and immediately announced they would introduce separate legislation to repeal this section of the funding bill.
The dysfunction is just profound. Congress passes a law to resolve a national crisis, and its own leadership is immediately trying to undo a self-serving provision inserted by the other chamber.
It transforms the appropriations process into a battleground for interbranch legal warfare.
And beyond Congress protecting itself, the executive branch continued its systematic assault on congressional oversight,
specifically targeting the Government Accountability Office, or GAO.
The power struggle between the White House OMB and the GAO intensified right upon reopening.
OMB Director Russ Vought issued a formal directive to all executive agency heads, and it stated that legal opinions issued by the GAO are now considered non-binding.
Why is that statement a fundamental assault on Congress's authority?
Because the GAO is Congress's nonpartisan audit arm. Its core function, mandated by law, is to issue legal opinions ensuring the executive branch spends appropriated money legally and according to Congress's intent. It's critical to the power of the purse.
So by declaring the GAO's opinions non-binding,
the OMB is asserting that the president has sole unilateral authority over how and when appropriated funds are spent. It effectively neuters Congress's primary tool for holding the executive fiscally accountable.
It's an existential threat to checks and balances.
Absolutely. And we also see clear evidence of the administrative state being weaponized against political opponents.
Most clearly involving the Federal Housing Finance Agency, the FHFA.
It's a textbook case of score settling. The FHFA is supposed to be this independent financial regulator overseeing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It's meant to operate completely outside of political pressure.
But the director, Bill Pulte, is a staunch administration ally.
And he referred a vocal critic, Representative Eric Swalwell, to the DOJ for a criminal investigation.
Related to alleged false or misleading statements in loan documents.
Right. And this was not an isolated incident, was it?
Far from it. Swalwell noted publicly that he was the 4th high-profile, outspoken critic of the administration to be referred by Director Pulte.
He followed similar criminal referrals against New York Attorney General Letitia James, Representative Adam Schiff, and the independent Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook.
This pattern just demonstrates a systematic campaign to weaponize the investigatory powers of a federal financial regulator.
To intimidate, silence, and harass the administration's most prominent political opponents.
Finally, let's discuss the high-level and very contradictory White House strategies surrounding the release of new Jeffrey Epstein documents.
While the government was reopening, a new trove of Epstein emails was released by Democratic sources,
including one alleged 2019 email that claimed the president knew about the girls.
Right. And the White House public response was completely dismissive. They branded the release as another Democrat plus mainstream media hoax and a distraction from their political victory on the shutdown.
That was the public spin. What were the private actions being taken at the same time?
The private actions revealed deep concern about the full content of the files. Simultaneously with the public dismissal, President Trump personally met with Representative Lauren Boebert
to pressure her to remove her name from a discharge petition.
A petition that, if successful, would force a House floor vote on releasing all the unredacted files beyond what the Democrats had already put out.
And the stakes of that private meeting were high.
It was a high-level effort. Sources indicated the attorney general and the FBI director were also involved in pressuring Boebert.
This aggressive, high-level lobbying campaign implies the White House is profoundly concerned about the potential damage in the full unreleased files,
which directly contradicts their public dismissal that the whole story is a hoax. It's a perfect illustration of the tension between narrative control and crisis containment.
We have detailed an extraordinary and chaotic 48 hours. The government was reopened, but the legislative branch immediately retreated. The House went into recess until November 17th.
While the executive and judicial branches engaged in a full contact flurry of operational, political, and institutional actions.
That lack of congressional presence is an action in itself, isn't it?
It is. It underscores that Congress has really just ceded the initiative of governing to the executive agencies and the courts.
The shutdown resolved nothing fundamental.
It simply created 2 new deadlines for future crises: the ACA vote in December and the CR in late January. And it unleashed this pent-up policy agenda focused on radical deregulation, institutional power grabs, and political score settling.
So here is the final takeaway for you, the listener. The immediate human cost, the SNAP benefit pause, the financial stress on federal workers, and the strategic high-profile executive pivot.
The foster care EO, the multi-billion dollar trade deals.
They were inextricably linked. The White House leveraged the end of the crisis to aggressively pursue its core priorities across all departments, using the entire federal apparatus as a mechanism for political and ideological change.
Every department was instantly utilized to secure policy wins and to neutralize political opponents.
So we have seen the legislative branch immediately retreat, the executive branch aggressively pivot and weaponize, and the judicial branch intervene in a spending fight only to then reverse itself.
And given the depth of these institutional conflicts, Congress versus the DOJ, OMB versus the GAO, and independent regulators targeting political critics, does the lack of congressional presence mean that governing has fundamentally shifted?
Has it moved away from the lawmakers and permanently into the hands of the executive and the courts?
What does a functional government even look like when its component parts are actively at war with each other, using the law to settle political scores? That is the profound question you are now better equipped to answer as these crises accelerate toward December and January.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the federal news of November 13th and 14th, 2025.
We'll see you next time.